Can you imagine what it feels like to be a Canadian soccer player as Peter Pendergast blows the whistle? It's official. Canada 2000 Gold Cup champions. How does that sound?
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo and Thomas Neff.
It's episode 11 of the Northern Football Podcast. I'm Peter Galindo, joined by Thomas Neff. How are you doing, good sir?
Good, my friend. My audio mic from my phone has been fixed and improved from last week. We have a new upgraded logo thanks to one of our listeners and graphic designer, Jahil Gushwe. Hope you enjoyed our interview with Scott Kennedy last episode. We will try our best to have other national team players on the podcast in the future. We could have some exciting news of our own regarding a partnership, so watch out for that. Jam-packed episode today. John Herdman spoke. A lot of movement with the Canadians in Europe. And of course, we got your requests on Canadians Abroad mailbag and as well as a poll.
Yes, indeed. And we're going to get started with our poll, which is Vancouver Whitecaps versus Club de Foot Montreal or the Montreal Impact in a previous life. Is it a derby? And the final votes came in, and out of 177 votes, 75% of you said no, while 25% said yes. Now, Thomas, just by pure definition, I agree with how this went, because derbies are contested by teams from the same city or region, and Vancouver and Montreal do not come from the same city or region, but you have to say it's a rivalry for sure.
Oh, absolutely. The rivalry extends back to the USL days. They were very, very heated, not only in the Canadian Championship, but as well as the USL. A lot of former players that came from those teams represented Canada together. And quite honestly, like, I don't know how many games they've played between the two, but I remember this was pre-2010. I would stay up and watch the games on Sportsnet when they'd be on, and just how interesting it would be, like, for guys like Mauro Biello. This has more meaning to them because obviously they used to be, they would play each other more often, I think. Right now, they don't get to play each other as much.
Yeah.
Because obviously they don't play in the same conference.
Yes.
But it's interesting because the same definition of a derby, that would kind of disqualify Montreal and Toronto, eh? Because they're not in the same region, but
yeah,
obviously they are close enough. It's definitely a rivalry, but not a derby. Our listeners got that right.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I have a lot of memories myself just attending some of those games. I mean, remember I wasn't there for this, but just the aftermath of what happened, the miracle of Montreal in 2009, that sparked the Southsiders' Je me souviens, which means I remember, banner, commemorating, I suppose, that night, and just kind of saying like, hey, you know, Montreal, you guys purposely threw the game. That's what a lot of Vancouver diehards think. But then you had the 2011 Voyageurs Cup semifinals, Malouda Kluel scoring an extra time for Vancouver against a then lower league Montreal Impact. Hassoun Kamara's late winner in the 2013 final. They had some really intense playoff meetings. So, I mean, just a lot of really good games and just a lot of bad blood from those games, which is what makes the rivalry. And the reason this was our poll this week is because they obviously played each other on Saturday, and it was the Whitecaps who came out the 2-0 victors. The goals were scored by Christian Dahomey, one from the penalty spot and the other via a header from a corner. But Thomas, Vancouver still has the same issues creating chances in open play. So for that reason, should we be pessimistic about them and the next few weeks here, or should we be optimistic because they haven't hit their stride, yet they still have 7 points from their first four games?
Yeah, I think this is a result that on paper can fool a lot of people. I mean, yes, they scored 2 goals, and hey, maybe this is a way for Marco Santos to find ways to get the best out of Christian Dahomey and company week in, week out. I remember he mentioned in his presser, just the surge of guys that came back from injury made the Whitecaps more competitive throughout the week. Gives me the impression that Dos Santos created a more competitive environment than maybe previous years, considering he says he kind of hinted sort of like, hey, if you don't play well, your spot maybe up for grabs, considering how good the youth has been. And I'm not just talking about Baldissimo, but other young guys have stepped in, played a couple of minutes in there, and have impressed enough. What I would say is the Whitecaps need to stop relying on Maxim Crépeau. I mean, he was fantastic.
Yes.
Again, another MVP performance, standing on his head, but of course, they need to be better defensively.
Well, of course, but I feel that was probably their worst defensive game of the year so far, and yet it still wasn't entirely bad, at least when you compare it to the last 2 years. And that's one of the reasons why I'm a little more optimistic about Vancouver, because they're not conceding a boatload of shots like they were in the previous 2 years. And this is with Andy Rose at center back, which, he wouldn't be one of the go-to guys if everybody was fit. Still a bit curious that Derek Cornelius hasn't started yet, despite the fact he's been back from injury for a couple of weeks. And then Bruno Gaspar hasn't been integrated yet at right back. And Jake Marinski was horrid in this game. Like, he had a really tough time, specifically in the second half, when Lassi Lapalainen came on and started running circles around him. But it's really for those reasons that they're able to maintain a defensive base that keeps them in games, and then they strike from a set piece and they're able to get a win. But the issue is less than 25% of their total expected goals have been generated in open play so far this season. I think they're averaging 0.35 XG in open play per 90 minutes so far, which is just not good enough if you want to not only make the playoffs, but kind of do something in the playoffs, like make it past a round or two. I'd like to see what happens when Baldissimo and Caio Alexandre start together in midfield. If Russell Tiber continues to start for the next few weeks, I really have to question Mark Dos Santos in that regard, because if you want to play with this fast, high-pressing tempo and style, you can't have players like Russell Tiber out there who are quite simply replaceable. To their credit, Alexandre and Bekele were progressing the ball nicely at times, but the fullbacks need to still be more involved as well. They're playing a bit too deep in possession, and just overall, the team needs to play with a higher tempo, transition faster, and just not be so indecisive in the final third. That's why I feel like if you get everybody in there who would be a first-choice player, and put the Tiberts and the Roses on the bench, you might start to see a bit of improvement there.
In the last episode, we mentioned sort of this disorganized way of play, how you saw some players just playing all over the pitch,
Yes.
not a specific position. Do you think that changed this week compared to last, or you think it's still unstable in that regard?
Yeah, I think it was a bit better. I think part of the reason why is I just don't think they were as aggressive pressing from the front, which is when you started to see guys question what their role should have been or where they should have been positioned. But then on the downside, that's when you get the fullbacks playing super deep and not getting forward. And then you're relying on your three forwards to do the creating and the scoring. So that really is the big issue for me. But yeah, like I said, I'm still optimistic because they've gotten 7 points from these 4 games. And last year and the year before that, they didn't put many of these runs together, if any. So that kind of bodes well, but they can't be so one-dimensional going forward because they will eventually crash back down to earth.
Yeah, and for Montreal, like the Nashville defeat, Montreal was dominated in the air, but chance creation wise, they don't look too hot either. Did they miss Zachary Brault-Guillard for you?
Yeah, I think so. And I think without him, that's when you saw the responsibility of the attacking buildup from the flanks going to Mustafa Kiza, whereas I feel before it leaned more towards Brault-Guillard. And with Clément Bahia starting, look, he wasn't a liability, but he wasn't impacting things in the final third, and that kind of hurt them in the end. But on the flip side, Georgi Mihailovic needs to be deployed further up the pitch, because when he received passes further upfield to start the second half, especially, that's when he started pulling the strings and kind of picking apart the Whitecaps' defense. Now, having a guy like Lapalainen out there who can kind of run at defenders and kind of keep them on their toes helps too. But Mihailovic can't be dropping deep as much as he does, simply put. You signed him to be that creative, to fill that creative void that was left behind by Safir Taider when he left midway through last season. And so far, you're seeing flashes of it. It's just not as consistent. And in games where Montreal gets beaten in the air as much as they do, that is a problem. And speaking of that, Thomas, I wanted to ask you this. Kamal Miller probably had his first mistake-laden game in a Montreal shirt. He obviously
was
conceded the
just about to
penalty,
mention that.
and he got obviously beaten on the corner by a 5'9" Grishin Dahomey, which is not at all ideal. What did you make of his performance on the whole?
Well, the interesting thing about Kamal Miller is he's still so young, so you don't expect a player to hit his prime until he hits 25, 26, and so forth. What I actually found surprising is that Kamal Miller actually went on Twitter and apologized to the fans. I think most players don't apologize when they make a mistake.
Oh, very few.
It's hard also, right? It's hard to swallow your pride, admit you made a mistake. Maybe you admit it within the locker room. But social media is sort of that thing where you can kind of reach the fans directly. I think it's a good sign that he did admit his mistake. Look, man, the guy is 97 year born. I think he'll make more mistakes like this, but I don't think it's something to be concerned about. As long as he has, out of every five games, he has four good performances, maybe one bad game.
Right.
That's kind of the consistency level you're looking at this point. As far as your point that you made about CBG, I don't think he was missed defensively, considering
Right.
that's one of his weaknesses.
Yeah.
But I do agree with you. I think he was missed offensively. Not only the goal that he scored before, but like you said, he creates something different on the flanks. And I know that in open play, fullbacks have become more attack-minded over the last years, like how the game has the evolution of the game as a whole. The majority of the time, the fullbacks are sort of expected to go up the pitch and then pass. But Zach Brossolard goes up the pitch, and you think yourself, man, this guy would actually maybe could play as a forward.
Yeah.
But then again, how many minutes would he actually get if that were the case?
Yeah.
About Georgia Mihailovic. Look, I think I was reading an interview that he gave when he did sign for Montreal. The reason he signed for Montreal was Thierry Henry. And Thierry Henry kind of not promised him things, but he did promise him that, he was gonna, take him on his wing, learn from him and sort of deploy him a certain way. I'm sort of questioning whether with Wilfred Nancy coming in, that the same promise has been kept, like that he was going to have a certain role, he was going to play in certain positions, and if he had as good of a maybe relationship with Nancy, because obviously when you have Henry who leaves just before the season starts, and that's the guy that essentially brought you, I mean we've seen it in South America so many times, Peter, a head coach is brought by a current president or administration. And then the president or administration leaves, and the head coach or the player is sort of left like, oh wait, that's the that's the person who brought me here. So it's kind of an interesting situation. I do wonder if that's sort of the case. Nonetheless, he's still a quality player. I think he did well enough at the U23s, and I think he is, if he wasn't on the cusp before to get more U.S. men's national team call-ups, he definitely is on Berhalter's list.
Yeah, 100%. And it's not like he hasn't been, he's been terrible. I mean, he has actually, like I said, had his moments. It's just not fully there yet. And you wonder if it's just a case of figuring out the role as he goes along here, really. So yeah, not looking great for them. Vancouver's on the opposite end of the spectrum right now, but we'll see if that continues. Also on just a continued downward spiral. Toronto FC, they lost 2-0 to the New York Red Bulls, Chris Armas's former team. And Ali Curtis's former team, of course, TFC still winless in MLS and have just one win in seven games across all competitions. That lone win was, of course, the second leg against Lyon in the round of 16 of the CONCACAF Champions League. Now, Thomas, we've seen this team's depth and academy graduates praised in the past, and even as recently as this year when they were, getting past Lyon and taking on Cruz Azul. And I understand the quality of a player varies, but usually when you make changes and when injured players are out and they have to be replaced, you expect a semblance of continuity with the basics, like playing style, tempo, tactics, all that stuff. We don't see that with TFC yet. Is that the most concerning aspect for you through these first seven games of 2021?
It's interesting, Peter, because I actually saw a statistic from last season, and obviously last season Greg Vanney was in charge, and it seems like this season they're encouraging long balls, as opposed to last season they were building out of the back.
Right.
May I just say, Alexis Bono's distribution has been horrendous.
Oh, it always has been.
And it's not all Bono's fault, but Gonzalez, man, I just think the age factor is catching up to him. I think Mavinga coming in helped a lot.
Yep.
I think Lawrence will help. Obviously, Moro is already on the bench anyways.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about that, when Lawrence comes in and he has done the proper quarantine and he's clear to play by MLS standards,
mm-hmm.
you'll see one of Auro and Larea play on the right. And Lawrence, I think he'll really take that left side to his own.
Yeah.
But I still think, and I don't know how they're going to do it, because they just either don't have enough money on the salary cap, but man, they need a new center back. It's not that I don't trust in Luke Singh, but it seems like, are these guys ready to play 30 games, 90 minutes each, the whole way from beginning to end? I don't think they are. I think they have to be brought year to year. First year play 7 games, second year play 12, you know, third year play 18. I don't think you should just throw a guy out there. Maybe the only one that could do it could be Akinola. He has big shoes to fill with Jozy Altidore, who just continues to be injured and not even making the 18. Something I think when he was vaccinated, I think he became ill. But they need Alejandro Pozuelo immediately.
Clearly they do. But this kind of goes back to the original question. Like, I understand you're not going to get an exact carbon copy of performance every single week. But to get so thoroughly outplayed in most of your games, even in the 1-1 draw with Leon, they were thoroughly outplayed. Leon just could not finish to save their lives that day. That really is the problem, that there just doesn't seem to be any sort of structure. And I get that the way that they play is very intricate. They didn't have a lot of training sessions prior to, I think it was up until the first leg against Cruz Azul. But since then, they've had about a week and a half here to work on these things, and it just doesn't seem like it's really come together all that much. But I think part of the reason why it hasn't is you have certain players like Omar Gonzalez struggling big time in that high line because they just don't have the attributes to play that way. Like, when he gets pressed, not very good on the ball. He's obviously not fast enough. Like, he looks like legitimately like a pickup player out there at times. Just getting completely out-hustled by these young New York Red Bulls players. And really, when it's just on the other end, when it's just Michael Bradley kind of driving the attack, that's when you have a bit of a problem. Because Larea and Auro were non-factors in attack, which hindered the buildup even more. And it's also not helpful when you have a striker like Ayo Akinola who doesn't get involved in that regard. To his credit, he was pressing more often, which is encouraging because he didn't do that much last year. So maybe that keeps him in the 11 for now. But his half chance aside in the first half, there was nothing going for TFC. And this was the issue. And the other big takeaway from this for me was, you look at the Red Bull side of things, and they had 17-year-old Caden Clark, who was arguably the man of the match. And on the other side, you had Jaden Nelson, who is a year older than Clark, but doesn't look anywhere near as impactful still. And they've played the same amount of professional minutes, Clark and Nelson. And then you have TFC coaches comparing Jaquiel Marshall-Ruddy to Alphonso Davies. And, you know, going back to my conversation 2 weeks ago about being too quick to hype up players, is this another lesson that we need to be cautious with some of these guys, just given that players do develop at different times and they maybe require a bit more patience and molding?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think, Marshall Ruddy, he's 16 years old. Nelson's 18. You got to give these guys time. They don't just become world-class players. Any player doesn't become a finished player overnight. But the truth is, I think the hype comes more from within, like you mentioned. TFC coaches sort of hyping up their own players, which of course they have the right to. They're still good players, but I just don't think they've shown enough as to what they potentially can
Yes.
show.
Look, I still think TFC has to be patient with their players because if they believe in them, then trust them, be patient, give them the best platform to succeed. But bottom line for me, Jadon Nelson, in the opportunities he's gotten, hasn't really progressed in a certain way. Like he's a player who tends to just kind of dribble and think he can beat players with speed, but that just can't happen at this level anymore. Maybe when you're playing at under 17 level, it can, but when everybody is, the same speed, same height, strength, and whatnot, you need to be smarter with your decision making. And Nelson right now just doesn't create chances, coughs up possession a lot, and tends to be a bit of a black hole when it comes to those situations. And yes, he's only played about, what, 350, 400 minutes at the MLS level. But that's where the coaches have to work with them and tell them, hey, listen, in these situations, maybe try looking for a teammate or do this or do that. And that's the difference with a player like him and Caden Clark, in that you see Clark is a bit more resourceful with the ball. And then with the Marshall Ruddy thing, look, if he's in any way comparable to Alphonso Davies, like Danny Dicchio and Bill Manning say that he is, he needs to be starting more, like whatever the situation is. Because you have to remember, too, Davies, a month before his 17th birthday, which is where Marshall Ruddy is currently, Davies had logged over 2,200 minutes of professional club football, had 4 goals, 2 assists. He was starting games versus Tigres in the Champions League and not looking out of place, scored some big goals in the Champions League against MLS teams. He was debuting for Canada and winning the Gold Cup Golden Boot. I do understand that the Canadian national team landscape is a lot different now compared to when Davies was breaking through. But this is why these comparisons are so ludicrous and don't help the player at all, because Alphonso Davies is a unicorn at this point in Canadian soccer. And if in any way Marshall Ruddy is on anywhere near the same level as Davies was at that age, then he has to be playing. Like if he is as good as you say he is, put him in the 11. Give him a chance. Give him a run of games. Like simply put, that's why these comparisons are just so ridiculous to me because they don't help anybody. It just hinders the player.
Yeah, I think it definitely makes fans and media sort of it makes the expectations so high that these comparisons are endless, and not just endless, but you're always being compared to something. So if you underperform, it seems like that's always going to be the thing that's going to be said, unless obviously you match that bar. I think the biggest thing for me, obviously, Soteldo making his debut. What did you think about Soteldo's debut?
I mean, given that it was his first game and the team was struggling, I mean, I thought he did okay. It seemed like kind of going back to the conversation we had about, Whitecaps players not knowing what their role was. Soteldo was kind of all over. Like he started in behind Akinola, then he went to the right, went to the left. I think he was just trying to make things happen, and to his credit, he was trying. And at the very least, that's what you're going to get from Soteldo, I think, is that you're going to see a guy trying to grab the game by the scruff of the neck and try to make something out of nothing. It just wasn't coming off for him because the rest of the team around him just was not up to snuff that day. What did you think?
I do think that once Pozuelo comes in and Osorio and they play together, Osorio and Pozuelo, I think that's going to make a big difference. Delgado didn't look great.
That's not his role, in fairness, but yeah.
Yeah, but man, just going back to the goalkeeping, what I was saying earlier, I think it might be time for Westberg to get his chance.
It absolutely should be.
If he hadn't missed the start of training camp due to personal reasons, I think he'd still be the number one right now.
Yeah, probably. But I mean, to me, Bono hasn't really locked down that spot, and yet he continues to keep it, which I feel is very curious in my eyes.
So in all fairness to Bono, I will say this, and because obviously you and I both played semi-competitive soccer as a goalkeeper. He hasn't been great, but he hasn't been terrible. Like he's allowed the goals that like most goalkeepers won't get to. He hasn't made an obvious mistake as far as a shot stopping
No,
goes,
no.
But he hasn't made he hasn't saved his team from earning points, you know? Like the great goalkeepers are the ones that steal a point or two. I just don't think he's done that. But yet again, he hasn't been horrendous. I think it's more so his distribution, lack of confidence. Although I will say this, I think his footwork needs work. For example, that he allowed against Cruz Azul, the long ball.
Right.
I think he could have taken a step one, two, and then with the one hand up. I don't think he should have dived for it right away. That he had some time. But, I mean, yet again, I mean, it happened so quickly that in that moment.
The thing with Bono is any one of those aerial situations he's always struggled with. Like, I feel he's always hesitant to come off his line and claim something or get a fist to it. And that's what really hurts him a lot of the time. And that's also why, for me, he's really not the best option in goal. Westberg is shorter. Yes, I get that. And that's what maybe gives him an even bigger liability in those situations. But at least he's decisive and does go for the ball. Whereas I feel Bono does not. And also, Westberg is just better with his feet overall. So, you know, for me, it's a no-brainer.
It's part of the modern game. And just to say this, I know I'm very not critical, but I do like to make points about the age factor. I just don't think that applies in the goalkeeping situation.
No.
I think the goalkeeping situation, it's like a fine wine. The older it gets, the more kind of complete it gets. And I just think goalkeepers can play until 40. Now, 40-year-old midfielder, completely different story.
Of course.
Moving on to the second segment of the episode, John Herdman spoke.
Yes.
He gave an exclusive on One Soccer late last week to discuss a variety of subjects. The juiciest bits were related to squad selection and who might make the cut for the qualifiers and Gold Cup over the next 2 months. Herdman mentioned the abundance of MLS players getting regular minutes. And he mentioned names, yes. Tara Pascher, Michael Baldissimo, Tejan Buchanan, Ralph Priso, etc., who weren't involved in last camp. He also stated that he sent out the widest squad list of potential players, and Tesh Akindele still wasn't on it. So gives you the impression that it's gonna be a competitive 23 no matter what. But we could see some familiar faces next month.
We've got such a big group that I've pretty much enveloped everyone in this selection. And, you know, if you're saying, like, are guys pushing through, they're probably on the list, you know, guys that you're thinking about that have been, you know, making a little mark in MLS or in Europe somewhere at the U23 level. And nobody's off the table. Like, it's form in these next few weeks that are going to make a big difference. I mean, some of these young kids in MLS may make a difference. Theo Corbenau may make his Premier League debut. So, you know, there's still like 3 weeks of stuff that's going to happen that'll probably tip my hat one way or another towards a few faces that could be fresh and new or more experienced faces.
Given those comments that we just heard from Herdman, which surprise call-ups do you expect? The fact that he specifically mentioned guys playing at the under 23 level kind of set off a light bulb in my head. I don't know about you.
Yeah, of course. I think it's obvious. Diaz, Flores, Jevison, Corbiano.
Yeah, guys like that, for sure.
Yeah, I think it would be nice. And I'm not going to go too much into it in this episode because Peter and I do have something in mind to preview what a Gold Cup team could look like. But I'm excited. Canada has four crucial games in the June window. And if Canada does qualify to the octagonal, they have three games in September, three games in October, and two games in November. So I just do not see how our best 23 can play all of those games, including Gold Cup. I think Gold Cup is going to be an amazing opportunity to capitalize some players, some dual nationals, to get some guys that are outside looking in as far as MLS, guys like Pascher, guys like Akindele, maybe give Tiber a run of games. And obviously not everyone will make the team, but I would love to see Dane Sinclair and so forth. But that's what I think. I think qualifiers is their priority. I mean, I think Qatar 2022 has to continue to be the goal, but if Herdman brings a young, exciting group of players and mixed in with them some experienced guys who are kind of on the cusp, want to catch Herman's eyes. There, I just don't see how a scenario where you lose. I only see win-win. At best, you capitalize some players, you expand your player pool from 30 to maybe 40 players, and you really see what you have. On that point, I think it's a win-win.
Oh, it absolutely is. And but I mean, yeah, and it's not even just the European guys, although I do expect, I mean, Corbiano at this point is probably going to be a regular face in those camps. I mean, now that he's gotten that first call-up and cap out of the way. But it's really up to how many of, you know, Dias, Flores, and Jebison get the call-up for me. But, you know, the fact that he mentioned specifically under-23 players in Europe or guys playing in Europe at the under-23 level, just, you know, I mean, anybody with half a brain who's been following this could tell you, oh, okay, clearly these guys are going to be considered. Whether they accept the calls is another
thing. That's the thing. If you're Dias and you're Flores, the opportunity to start against the United States in the Gold Cup, the first match, what an opportunity that is.
If they go to the Gold Cup, yes, yes.
Yeah. But if you're Sporting and you're Arsenal, you watch that game, they both play good. Arsenal and Sporting, you know, they see the on an international competition, pretty much making his professional debut in a tournament like this.
Do you think that any of those guys are going to be involved in June, or do you think that they're just earmarked for the Gold Cup, provided they, again, accept the call-ups?
I think there might be a room for one or two, but I still think that Herman will go with a strong squad.
Yeah, I think that's fair. A couple of the other potential names that I thought maybe could be involved, I mean, we spoke to him last week, but Scott Kennedy, it seems like, will get called if he can attend this time. And I mean, he said as much to us last week.
If they gave Sturing a chance, they're definitely going to give Kennedy a chance. Yeah, there's just no way.
Do you think, because again, he mentioned my name and the fact Tesho Akindele is out, do you think Tyler Pascher is in for the qualifiers, or is he more a Gold Cup guy?
So obviously what you and I both learned from the interview of Scott Kennedy, Herman sends out a list of potential names. He reaches out to players that are in consideration.
Yep.
For each window, and he speaks to them a couple weeks before each window. So there's the thing of, is he going to be considered? Is he going to make the 23? He is considered. Okay. Will he make the 23? Is a completely other thing.
Do you think he does make the 23 is my question.
Yeah, so it's funny. I actually had this chat with Twitter follower. If you include four center backs, not five, and you bring in Davies, David, Laren, and Cavallini, those four forwards. Let's not forget, Junior Hoyles hasn't played in months for Cardiff, and we'll get to him a little later. But you still have two more places for forwards, so I think it's gonna be really, really interesting. Maybe some U23, maybe some Pascher. Although I think the urgency level with guys like Jebson Flores is more because Pascher is not a dual national.
Of course. So Pascher will always be there, which is obviously advantageous. But good thing that they do have the Gold Cup, right, coming up. Because then, hey, if you don't get called up for the qualifiers, we have the Gold Cup. And that's a chance for players to get meaningful minutes in a Canada shirt in a tournament setting, in a competitive setting, when they otherwise wouldn't have gotten that look. And that's what's so advantageous.
Absolutely. And again, I know you and I were disappointed with our U23s. I know I definitely knew that they could have done more, but I do think from there you can take out four or five guys, and then all the other guys that did miss that tournament due to club commitments as
well. Exactly, and a few of them we are probably going to touch on in the mailbag. But before we do, Herman was also asked about Suriname and their recruiting of dual nationals recently. They've obviously gotten a bunch of European-based players to commit to them, and I believe it was seven got their first caps in March, and a further three have committed for June. And this has sparked a bit of a debate about whether Canada should be worried about them. Thomas, I know you and I differ on this, so let's just get right into it. Let's get heated. Do you think that Canada as a team should be worried about Suriname?
All right. Before we get into this, Peter, I'm going to call you out. Last time, I think you overhyped Bermuda, even with two or three players that they did have. They had really good players, two or three of them. There was just no way Canada was going to lose that game against Bermuda. And
I know they were missing never said seven they were going to
players.
Lose. Never said they were going to lose. Just that they were going to
never lose.
The
but you know, there was that worry that it could be close. With this game, I think it will be close. I think Canada will win by 2-0 or 3-0. Okay. But because of the continuity that Canada has, so many games, so many camps that it's been together over the process, even before World Cup qualifying in the friendlies, and even that 2017 process that Octavio Zambrano started, I just think that Canada is still very much the favorites. And Suriname, this team, obviously, they haven't played much together. And I know you will disagree with this, but I think Suriname is at the same level to Curaçao. I think there is natural comparisons there. Most of the Curaçao players are also dual nationals with Dutch passports. And a lot of them are playing or have played or have experienced the top flight of Dutch football. And just to go over some of the names, I think their back four is outrageous good. The thing where there might be a bit of concern is obviously their goalkeeper. He's Anderlecht's number two, Han. And then I think their midfield is still weak. You have guys from leagues like Trinidad and Tobago, the Israeli league. I think their midfield still need work. But they got very, very big acquisitions, committing guys playing in the Bundesliga like Becker, Union Berlin.
Who's not a regular
another forward?
Yeah.
Right. But it still is the Bundesliga. Let's not forget.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, we have a Bundesliga player playing, and he plays every week for the best team in the world. So I mean, you know,
big difference. Right? I think our front three is one of the best in CONCACAF. But anyway, I think the continuity factor will be something that will hurt them a lot, because the team that qualified to the Gold Cup was mostly of domestic players for Suriname. And I think right now, if I'm not mistaken, only like six players from that team are remaining. I think the dual nationals kind of just took over and the rest have been shoved aside.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because in the interview that Herdman gave to One Soccer, they pulled out this graphic. And those are the guys that have committed. Guys that have yet to make decisions are in the clubs like Ajax, Club Brugge, Crystal Palace, Mainz, Utrecht. So this team that right now, the current team, the current crop of players that they have compared to the current crop of players that Canada will face could be slightly different. I don't think they'll get every single player that they're trying to convince. But to me, this team is still a worry. But like I said again, I think Canada should win 2-0, 3-0.
I'm in agreement with you actually on most of this, which I'm kind of surprised by. Clearly, they are going to be a tougher out than, say, Aruba or the Cayman Islands. And this is a good thing, a very good thing, because it will force them, Canada I'm talking about, to get everything right. They can't slack off. They got to do, like, that part of it is good because they'll actually take this seriously. Whether they should be worried, I still don't think they should be worried. Because here's the thing. Suriname, they capped those seven new players in March and can cap another three in June. Of those 10 players, six of them are regulars with their club. I'm talking like at least 1,200, 1,500 minutes at club level this season. Two of them play in Israel. One of them play in the Netherlands. One of them plays in Turkey. One in Cyprus. One in Saudi Arabia, who plays with my Peruvian brethren, Christian Cueva, by the way, at Al Fateh, and is part of the reason why he's having such a good season, I might add. Two of them are defenders, two are midfielders, two are forwards of those six regulars. And four of the six are 30 years of age or older. They most likely won't be around after this cycle. And of the 14 Euro-based players who played the March qualifiers, eight of them, so about half, were slash are starters at club level. And five of those eight are defenders because they play in a 3-4-3 or a 3-5-2. And yeah, some of them play for a pretty good team or at a high level, like, you know, a Maccabi Haifa in Israel, right?
Yeah, but let's not forget, Peter, some of these guys were even considered for the Dutch national team. It wasn't until recently some of those guys gave up on their dream to represent the Orange.
Like Ryan Donk, for example, of Galatasaray. He's one of those guys who's now the captain for Suriname. But here's the issue with all of that. Okay, some guys are playing regularly, some guys are not, so it's kind of a mixed bag in terms of like who's actually a quote-unquote star on their team and who isn't. Canada has a bigger advantage there because they have guys across the pitch who play regularly at a good to high level, and that's not just in defense, that's in midfield, that's up front. 7 of the 23, further to your point about continuity and whatnot, Thomas, 7 of Suriname's 23 players who got called up in March have played at least 8 times for the national team. So there's no chemistry with this new group yet. And that is a massive disadvantage. There'll be a tough out, yes, especially with their defensive structure. And that's where I think, you know, the chest puffing about, hey, we have, you know, players who play for Bayern Munich and for Lille and, you know, these guys. That's where you put your money where your mouth is and see just how good of a team you claim to have. Because it's all well and good to puff out your chest against the Cayman Islands and talk about your depth and quality, but then be so insecure that you might lose to a team like Suriname, who has a decent crop of dual nationals, but not everybody's really a regular. And isn't that the whole point right now when we talk about the mental side of a Canadian player, that this group is different because they're playing at a high level and are winning trophies, which is something Herbin always praises? Why then would they fold against a Surinamese team that have barely played together and have recruited, admittedly, you know, good-ish players, but are not at the level of a Canada yet? Like, I just don't get it. That's the side of it I don't get.
Yeah, so to your point, 2 things for me that stand out. Yes, I do agree with you, the age factor, but and I know you can't replicate the similar circumstance of playing as opposed to training, but to the guys that aren't playing, you're still in world-class environments week in, week out.
True. So same I to still think Canada, that though.
Right, so. Right, but I think that still needs to be considered, and they still, like you said before, they don't have enough players. Yes, they have maybe 8, 9, 10. But honestly, to build a group of players that is competitive enough, I think the minimum number of that should be at least 15.
It's going to be a more tricky game than what they've been used to so far, but that's not saying much. It's just one of those cases where put your money where your mouth is. If you are a fan or media member who boasts about how great this pool is, you should not be worried about this game at all, no matter what the past national teams have done to you, because this group is different, right? So therefore, this should be a bit of a cakewalk in comparison. It will still be somewhat yeah. tricky, but I'm just saying people are worrying for sure. way too much about this.
And to end on this point, if Canada doesn't beat Suriname and most likely Haiti, I know it's still not decided, but it will most likely be Haiti. If we don't beat Suriname or Haiti, then we don't deserve to be in the octagonal.
Well, exactly.
It's clear and simple. Yeah. I mean, we don't deserve to face Mexico, U.S., Costa Rica, Jamaica, Panama, Honduras. We just don't deserve to be there. So I yes. think we have to beat Haiti and we have to beat Suriname. It's yep. as simple as that.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, my friend. And with that, we're going to jump into the mailbag here, Canadians Abroad version. Thank you to those who submitted questions. You can always submit questions to us to answer on the show. No topic is off limits, as we will show you based on some of the questions we received. We'll start with Edgar at CONCACAF Edgar, who asks, does anyone know the situation of Marcelo Flores and how likely he is to play or accept another Canadian call-up? Well, Thomas, we obviously talked about him. Do you think that this next month or two might determine that?
I definitely do think this. I do think that Herdman has had some sort of contact with him. Again, the fact that he accepted the call-up in January, yes, I know it was just a January camp, or as you and I like to call it, microciclo, mm-hmm. microcycle.
Yep.
But the fact he accepted a call-up in January is more than positive.
Yes.
I mean, that's just completely optimistic, because here's a guy that has sort of been on the shadows. He's been mentioned a couple times over the years as one of the big dual nationals that kind of should go after. And I think with England and Mexico, I think his chances of making that team and being an impactful player are just very slim, very mm-hmm. hard. Because the Mexico, even Mexico midfield, not even let alone England, there's just players that have over 100 games for Club America. and Tigres, and not even including the guys like Edson Álvarez, who play regularly for Ajax, and all those guys, right? So I think it's definitely positive. I do think there is a good chance we could see him. But I also wouldn't be surprised if he decides, hey, I mean, Arsenal invite him to a first-team camp, and he decides to go there. But again, as we mentioned before, when we were kind of a tease that the Gold Cup, what a Gold Cup team could look like, I just don't know how you turn down an opportunity to start against the U.S., knowing that you're still not signed to a first-team contract in Arsenal, and the U.S. team is stacked, right? You could see, you know, some game time against very high competition like the U.S. in the first game, and just how what that could do for him. Let's not forget, I think it works both ways. Your national team helps your club success and could help you get seen, and I think your club could get you that international exposure. So I think it works both ways. Yeah.
To your point, to kind of emphasize this and close this out, Mauro Biello spoke about Flores before Olympic qualifying, and he said, and I quote, "At the moment, for sure, Canada is interested in Marcelo as a player. Going forward, there will be opportunities down the road for this young player, and Canada will do its best to try and bring him across to our team." So just kind of further hammers home the point that they're going to probably try everything possible to get him in for June or July. And like you said, this is the case with every young dual national. They can get competitive games right away and be further ahead in the pecking order, even compared to a Mexico. Now, dipping back into the mailbag, Ken MNT Opinions at Sad Since 86 asked, "Where next for Liam Miller?"
I think, naturally speaking, has to be the championship. I think he's shown enough in League One to make the jump to the championship. Look, I don't think you have to be a superstar in League One to make the jump to the championship. Every player's path is different. I mean, just to go on, a guy like Dean Henderson, who's now Manchester United goalkeeper and possibly England number one, he played very few games in National League, for example, when he was loaned out there. So I don't think things are a straight path as people may seem it is. You don't have to check boxes, per se. Play 30 games, be a starter for X amount of games, or score this amount of games. I think every player's path is different. I think he's shown enough flares that he can't play in the championship level.
Wherever he ends up, whatever club it's at, he is 21 and he can still develop into a solid, solid player. As long as he makes the jump to a club at that championship, or maybe even like a Bundesliga club who could, you know, a lower level Bundesliga club who could give him the minutes, that'll play him regularly in a role he's suited for, which is allowing him to drift inside to influence games. Because it's no surprise that the last couple of weeks of him looking very good for Charlton has coincided with him being able to do that. And that's going to be the case wherever he ends up from here on out.
Our next question is from Vince Alvarado at Vince by Demand. Georgi Atanasov at Arda in Bulgaria. Looks like one for the future, perhaps?
I would say he's definitely worth keeping an eye on, for sure. And to those who don't know Atanasov, 17 years old, plays for Arda in Bulgaria, as Thomas mentioned. They're top four in the league. But Atanasov, despite his young age and despite joining the club in January, has 150 minutes in about 9 appearances. Only 4 have been for 10 minutes or longer, but the fact he's involved with the first team and, you know, is getting games at this level at such a young age is quite impressive. I believe he was called up by Bulgaria's U17 squad, but didn't get capped. This was a couple of years ago now, I think. Typically deployed as a winger on either flank right now with Arda, but I put him right now in that Dominik Yankov kind of territory in that, you know, he's quick, tenacious, he tracks back, not afraid to get stuck in, has very good vision for a player that young, just lacks the strength in 1v1s and anticipation or decision-making in pressure situations. But if he can polish that off, and that will come with more minutes at this level, watch out, because I feel he is further along at this age than Yankov was in his age 19 season when he went on loan from Ludogorets to a relegation candidate in Bulgaria. And it's just hard to believe that Atanasov is 17 with that pace and vision and dribbling, really.
And one of our biggest weaknesses as a national team program was that we just didn't have enough games in a senior level that a guy like Yankov may have gone away, but I would put Atanasov in the same order as someone like Stefan Mitrovic getting semi regular game time in the Serbian Super League, but I think he's one to watch out for, and I think Herdman should pull the trigger sooner rather than later if he gets to a certain point. I mean, he, by the sounds of it, he's already in the Bulgarian program in the youth level. Next question is from Jeffrey Santos at Jeff Santos 86. Maybe impossible to talk about, but what's the status on players like Vlad Dijk and Juvi Kuna? Were these players ever considered for the Olympic team?
As far as I'm aware, no. Kuna just moved from the Whitecaps residency to Braga end of December, early January. And as far as I've seen, hasn't played for the under-23s or the B team yet. And Dijk is someone who I don't think is on the radar right now. So frankly, in the case of someone like Kuhner, if he can start to get minutes at the under-23 level soon or with the B team, maybe that's someone you start to monitor a little more closely. But for right now, probably worth, you know, not worrying right now about their playing time statuses, things like that. Now we got the first of actually three questions from at Winnipeg Garrito, who first asked us, given our youth program seems to be non-existent in the best of times, is it worth bringing these guys in? He mentioned specifically by name Jules Anthony Vilson, Justin Smith, and Ennis Sally, even just in a training capacity for a senior camp or a concurrent under 23 camp. Thomas, you and I have talked about, you know, microciclos, microcycles, and, you know, whether Canada should use them. I mean, it would just make sense to, you know, especially when you have a big youth tournament coming up.
Problem is with the microcycles, it usually is used more for local players.
Yeah.
Obviously, you wouldn't fly out players coming over from Europe and such just for a training stint. But I do think Vilsant and Smith are on the radar. I wouldn't say the same for Salih, but you never know.
And then, speaking of the senior camp, with Arfield out for the remainder of the season with injury and his status with the program in question anyway, does this provide further opportunity for David Witherspoon and perhaps Harry Payton to get a June call-up? What say you, Thomas?
Witherspoon, yes. Payton, no. I think Witherspoon has shown enough. And he, in fact, we're going to talk about him a little bit in our news and notes segment. I think Payton needs to play more in the Scottish Premiership for him to get a solid chance. He is one of the guys that I would consider for sure for potentially a Gold Cup. But yet again, I think it depends on the amount of minutes that he has. I think Witherspoon has impressed enough. I mean, just listening to John Herman's comments, it seems like he's more in than out.
Yeah.
Winning over a guy like Tybert.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yes, Arfield's absence opens up the best opportunity for someone like Harry Payton, his ability to be an all-action number eight, which I feel is his best role, not further up the pitch, but rather a bit deeper, who can carry the ball forward, progress it, recover possession, that sort of thing, gives him a prime opportunity to stake his claim. I just don't think it comes in what's going to be a very crucial month for the national team. It will be the Gold Cup, like you said. And I mean, Witherspoon's been killing it for St. Johnston, did well with Canada, and he's a veteran, so why not give him the chance again and bring him back, because he certainly deserves it right now.
And I hope we see Scott Arfield back soon, whether that's at the Gold Cup, whether that's most likely not at the June window, but whether we see him in September, because I still think he has something more to give.
Yes.
Although you never know with the midfield, because things change so much in a couple of months. Right now, for example, Stock is playing at Pacos Ferreira, in a couple more months he could be playing at Porto. So let's not forget, when Hutchinson wasn't in, Arfield was the captain, and now he's no longer in the call because of injury, I know, and because he rejected the call in March, but just tells you just how things change.
And closing out with this, Martin Amus, he has landed back in Uruguay in the Segunda División, the second division. Do you think this move is more beneficial to his development and future opportunities with the national team compared to that of the CPL?
I'm going to differ on this one. I think Primera División would, yes, but this is Segunda División, and Amus isn't young anymore. I mean, if Amos was 20, 21, 22, he's still at a level where scouts can come into Uruguay and pick him up. But at this age, when you're reaching 23, 24, he's a 97, by the way. So I just think at that age, I think you just, I don't think you get a lot of international exposure. I think he'd be much better playing in the CPL at this point.
Going through some news and notes to close out the show. Plenty of notable performances from other Canadians abroad this week. Alphonso Davies and Bayern Munich won the Bundesliga again. Davies' ninth trophy of his career at 20 years old. He ended up going the full 90 in the team's 6-0 win over Borussia Mönchengladbach. Jonathan David scored a goal in Lille's derby victory over Lens, moves them closer to their first Ligue 1 title in 10 years, and also set a record for most goals by a Canadian player in the top five European leagues. Tomasz Radzinski held the previous mark with 11 goals in the 2002-2003 Premier League season with Everton. Kyle Larin and Atiba Hutchinson could have won the Turkish Super League over the weekend if they had won their match against rivals Galatasaray and other results. But this was clearly a missed opportunity, and Larin, of course, coming off four goals from a week ago. Not so lucky this time, didn't have a great game overall. And then Dan Jevison making his Premier League debut with Sheffield United, going 25-plus minutes. Jevison, who is 17 years old still, was called up to England's under-18 squad in March, but was born in Oakville, Ontario. He's the 11th Canadian international to play in the Premier League, or a Canadian eligible player to play in the Premier League. Thomas, your thoughts on Jevison getting this debut this early, and just overall, I guess, what this could mean for his national team stock, because he could be one of those players who finds his way into a Canada squad in the next couple of months.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm sure most people didn't expect him to debut. We were all waiting for Corbiana's debut. I mean, how many bench appearances did he make for Wolves and still hasn't gotten a chance? Herdman was actually talking about in the interview that he gave to One Soccer. He said he was talking about Corbiano. He wasn't talking about Jefferson, but when he was talking about Corbiano, is, you know, if Corbiano makes his Premier League debut, he will join a select amount of players, and then, you know, could get a chance at the Gold Cup or, you know, at the crack or 23. Like, I'm sure that's how he's feeling about Jefferson now. Watching, you know, 25 minutes and what a way to make your debut. And the manager actually did say that he was impressed by him in the mm-hmm. 25 minutes that he saw, yep. and that he will get more minutes if he continues to play like this. It's an amazing fact. Yep. I just hope that Jevison accepts a Canada call-up and doesn't try and go for England. I mean, he was born in Canada and he moved abroad in 2017. So I think he would represent Canada.
You would think, and he'd just be way down the pecking order in England anyway. Look, I'm not at all surprised he got a debut. Paul Heckingbottom was his coach with the developmental team. When Heckingbottom got the interim job after Chris Wilder was sacked, I actually tweeted that Jeppesen, given his form at the under-23s, could find himself in the first team playing by the end of the season just based on the fact they were going to get relegated and they had nothing to lose. So now it's obviously happened. Maybe he'll get another couple of appearances here before they go down to the championship, and things will change. Elsewhere, sure. Tejon Buchanan started at right back for the New England Revolution and had a solid display against Alistair Johnston's Nashville, who had a tremendous game yet again. Daniil Henry was back in Suwon's starting 11 and logged 71 minutes in their win, moving up to third in the K-League. And Junior Hoylett announced he is leaving Cardiff City after 5 years and 184 appearances with the club. Very quickly, Thomas, where will his next destination be, do you think?
Probably will stay in England in the Championship. He'll probably find a club there. Although I would love to see him at Toronto FC in the MLS. And I'm sure a lot of people listening would as well.
And David Witherspoon, he's in the Scottish Cup final after a win over St. Mirren. And finally, according to Norwegian publication Nettavisen Sport, Sam Adekubi, who just began a season in Norway on May 9th, has an offer from two clubs, FC Rostov in Russia, and then Hungarian champions Ferencváros. Where would you rather him go, very quickly?
FC Rostov. It's not even a competition.
I agree with you there. And now we'll wrap up with some CPL talk here, because a lot of news ended up breaking over the last few days. Boran Santor at Soccer Fanatico on Twitter said, "I was involved with the legal team that brought Atletico to Ottawa. I'm hearing rumblings of Red Bull being interested in bringing a CAMPL club to a city that starts with an M. That is all I am allowed to leak." Any thoughts on this, Thomas?
Has to be either Montreal or Mississauga.
Not
no
Moncton,
way, it's Moncton.
Okay, interesting. Well, on that subject, you have another CPL update, because the league is going to reveal more details about the start of the 2021 season this upcoming Saturday. What are you hearing right now?
Yeah, so I tweeted out, it is my understanding that Newfoundland is now on the table, is now an option to host the CPL bubble tournament. I wasn't told any specifics as far as cities, but you would have to think that St. John's, as the situation in Victoria and Halifax has worsened, same with Winnipeg. I think the CPL is just looking for a way to make this tournament happen. However, it could still be held in those three cities that I just mentioned. I think just the league is keeping their options open as a whole. And League One Ontario just announced their revised schedule with a July 2nd start date, which is consistent with the CPL targeted date that has been reported in the past. Let's not forget, CPL owns League One Ontario. Calgary FC may have just made a huge splash.
Yes.
Probably the signing of the CPL, for me anyways, this offseason. That is English forward Joe Mason, who has signed a multi-year contract on a free transfer from MK Dons, has played in the majority of his career in the English Championship, even was in the Premier League briefly with Wolves, even though he didn't debut. This was before the ownership takeover. He has scored 5 goals in 16 games this season in League One. I expect him to tear the league apart.
Yes, and yet another solid English-based signing for Calgary. They've gotten a couple players from there, or at least who have pedigree there, and they've done pretty well overall. So that should be interesting to see when the season starts, whenever it starts. Hopefully we get more details over the next week here. That is going to do it for us. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and especially on a jam-packed edition. We hope you enjoyed it. You can follow the show at Northern Football on Twitter. You can follow me, Peter Galindo, at GalindoPW, and you can follow Thomas Neff at Thomas Neff. We will speak to you same time, same place next week.